Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. Well, football season's come to a close, my groundskeeping brethren, and that means it's time to think about the boys and girls of summer. With just days to go before pitchers and catches report to Major League Baseball spring training camp, it's time for spring training, groundskeeper style.
And we'll start that off with where it counts the most, our infield soils. Paul's going to talk about why and how you should have your infield soil tested and what secrets these tests can unlock for us.
In our Out of the Park segment, you've seen it in the news over the past year. The discussion of Major League Baseball has had about fan safety around the home plate area and dugouts from foul balls and out-of-control bats. Jim Merland, Beacon's in-house engineer, will be here to discuss backstop design and construction as we analyze the causes and the steps to consider for keeping your fans safe.
And then we'll finish up today discussing how to bring that infield skin back to life after its long winter's nap. We've got more time to work with it down south, but up here in the north, it's a whole different ballgame. We'll talk about how we do that differently.
We'll have all that and a baby update on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, and I'm joined by our very lovely and talented and very pregnant
and
Teresa Beyer.
Sick again.
The story of your whole pregnancy.
Pretty much.
Well, T, let's get to the important stuff first. It's time for the big baby update. I was at the STMA conference back a couple weeks ago in San Diego, and there were legions of your fans asking about what the situation was with the baby. Is it born? Has it been named? Is it a boy? Is it a girl? You know,
it is still a part of me. Due date is February the 7th, which as of this recording has not yet occurred. However, by the time we release it, may have occurred. We will update if that is the case, but so far, nope.
Nothing there. Huh?
Yeah.
Well, we had a great show at STMA and met many of our listeners, and well, we also strong-armed many more to listen to us this year. But there were people asking for you.
Aw, well, that's nice. I wish we could have been there. I tried to send my husband, but he's too good of a person and insisted on staying home in case the baby did come.
What I couldn't understand was people were asking about you, but they really didn't care about the fact that I was there. what do you expect?
It's because of your disdain for science,
yeah,
Paul.
Apparently, that's what it is. Yes, my. Apparently, there's more science lovers out there than I thought there were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hopefully, you know, next year you can make it to Disney for the STMA show there so we can have you in the booth so you can listen to all these people complimenting you.
We're hoping to get there.
The weather out there, of course, was gorgeous in San Diego. You know, I can never live there because it's too perfect. You know, it's the same thing every day. And that's the other thing. I need seasons. I got to have seasons.
Weirdo Wisconsinite.
But, hey, I love my winters and falls. But my only regret was that I didn't get time to go on a tour of the USS Midway aircraft carrier. I really wanted to do that, but I just couldn't find enough time to go and toured it. You know, you got to allow at least 2 hours of free time for that. And strangely enough, I just didn't have that during the hours, at least, that they were open. So who knows? Maybe I got to make a special trip back out there and just to see that. But plus, my sister lives out there. I couldn't hook up with her either while she was out there. Well, I was out there because she was busy. But anyways, the weather out there was putting me in a great mood for the baseball season. Mm-hmm. So our subjects today kind of reflect that since, like I said, football's over.
Well, I've got one more football piece.
Oh, yeah? What piece of football do you have?
Well, apparently the Super Bowl grounds crew prefers the Broncos.
Oh, you're going to dig that up, aren't you?
You know, all I can imagine is that there's one kid on the crew who's a huge Broncos fan. And the entire 2 weeks leading up to everything, he's like, I want to paint the Broncos side. I want to paint the Broncos side. I want to paint the Broncos side. And then finally, day of, somebody very sarcastically looks at him and goes, all right, fine, Bob, you paint the Broncos side. And he took him seriously.
At least he didn't misspell Broncos and, you know, like the famous commercial, the chefs, right? Right.
Yeah.
You know, my question is did George Toma have to go steal some sod from somewhere again to cover up that logo so he could paint it?
Oh, I bet he did, just to say he could do it.
That was a great story from the last show. For those of you who missed it, you got to go back and listen to the last show, our Super Bowl show with George Toma. Some really good stories there, especially towards the end.
Well, and he definitely got to test his philosophy of giving people a second chance.
I'll say.
Oh, God bless those guys. That's, you know, that's a lot of stuff to be thinking about on a daily basis. And then to have that happen. Oh, yeah.
A lot of pressure. There's media everywhere. You can't make one mistake without somebody catching you.
How did nobody catch it happening while it was happening?
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. Maybe they.
There was nobody in the upper stands who went, oh, somebody call the groundskeeper.
Nobody with a drone flying over saying, hey, something's wrong here.
Oh, man. Oh, well. It's easy to fix.
So football is pretty much at its end by the time you listen to this. The Super Bowl will be over, and hopefully my team wins. So, and I'm not even going to say what my team is because I got so much flack about choosing sides for the World Series. So with that, let's shift in to baseball mode.
Yep.
And our first segment today, we're going to talk about some things about testing your infield soils. And, you know, there's a lot of guys who are getting underway down south, and a lot of people are already well underway.
Yeah.
Colleges and whatnot have had practices, and probably some games are starting up down there. If they aren't, they will be starting very soon. So a lot of our groundskeeping cohorts have begun their work on their infields, and perhaps they weren't happy with the performance of their infield soils last season. You know, maybe they had recurring problems with their infield soils, things like that. They wouldn't drain well. They were too dry. They were too dusty or slimy or loose or too firm. There's 8 million different things that you can have problems with.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. And you know, before back in the day, as I always seem to say a lot on this, on this show, you know, back when I got into baseball in '85, you know, most of everything was purely guesswork. Nobody was testing that I saw. Nobody was testing infield soils.
Yeah.
Well, and there were, you know, there were a lot of great groundskeepers back then in the majors, but they didn't get the formal schooling, so they just didn't know what to look for.
Right.
So they, like everybody else, were dealing with buying, you know, native soils that were basically just harvested somewhere, mm-hmm. screened, and said, oh, there's your infield soil, and
make it work.
Make it work.
Yeah.
You know,
in some ways, they would say we're spoiled.
Yeah. Well, I feel that way because I didn't get the luxury of the engineered soils that are out there today. But as I worked through the 90s with the Orioles, I started doing a lot of writing of articles in our trade magazines talking about infield soils. And I started talking about you need to be testing your infield soils because the old line goes, you can't fix something if you don't know what's in it. And that's very true with an infield soil. Too many people, and this still happens to this day, too many people guess at what they need to add to an infield soil.
Yeah.
And there's no need for that because if you test the soil properly, it's going to show you all the issues that you've got.
Yep.
And so I spent most of the 90s teaching about this in articles and writing about it. And I had several major league groundskeepers call me up and say, hey, am I glad you put this information in? This is the best description about stuff that I've ever seen and that kind of stuff. I would have loved to have had this stuff when I was growing up, learning the business. And then when I got to Beacon here, we started doing testing here heavily, and we've been testing, you know, for 16 years now.
Yeah.
But at that time we could test and we could recommend in the early days here at Beacon, but I couldn't tell people where to go to get the materials they needed to fix it because at that time there was no unified product that was being made. It was still, everything was all, you know, whatever was pulled out of the ground. So, you know, I'd test their fields and I'd say, okay, well, here's what you need. You'll have to go look
Good
for
luck.
It on your own. Yeah. Because I know you got a lot of time to run around all the soil
right?
suppliers and find what you need. And, you know, So basically, let's cut to the chase here.
Yeah.
you know, if you're going to be testing your infield soils, you can't just go with a simple soil test that gives you the percentage of sand, silt, and clay. Oh. In the early days, that's what we all thought.
That's what we
did. All we need to know is, you know, how much sand, silt, and clay is in there.
Yep.
Well, that's great. But we learned very quickly that, you know, a 60% sand, 20% silt, 20% clay infield soil, you could have two or three different versions of that 60-20-20, and everyone would act differently.
I always forget about that.
So why is that? Well, why? They're all the same soil, aren't they? Well, no, they're not, because you haven't really looked at it all the way down to the nitty-gritty, mm-hmm. let's call it that. That's a good term for it. Because there's a lot that goes on with the sand, the distribution of sands. Mm-hmm. You know, when you take a look at the sand content, you can further divide that down into the sizes of sand, meaning anything from a very coarse all the way down to a very fine sand. But there's several different sizes.
Yep.
So, and how that breaks down, how the distribution of those sand particles break down, plays a huge role.
Yeah.
And you know, for a long time, we always thought, well, it's the silt that really causes all the problems in infield soils.
We did. Yeah, I remember being taught that.
And to a degree, that's true. Silt does cause a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. But we discovered later that sand, the distribution of the sand particles, plays also a big role. If you have too much fine sand in there, and very fine sand, you create a lot of instability. You actually need the medium and coarse and very coarse sands in there to be the majority of your infield soil, especially the medium and coarse sands. Because they're kind of the building blocks. They're like the girders in a building. Mm. They're the skeleton of the body. They provide the structural stability to hold that soil together and to be able to take the weight of a human body walking across it when it's wet so that you don't sink into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what we found was fields that had too much fine sand or very fine sand were very unstable, and those are the fields you step into and you sink. So ideally, we like to look at the infield soils that have sand that's primarily in the medium to coarse range. You're going to have some still in the fine range.
Sure.
We like that to be on the low end. When you look at fine and very fine, typically you want to keep that down around 20% or so combined.
And I do want to remind our listeners, we're talking about infield baseball soils. There are different structures and different things that you want for other sports and other uses.
And right, under grass situations, it's a different situation. Remember, in an infield soil, you don't have the luxury of having roots to stabilize that soil. You have to rely totally on the physical properties of that sand and how they come together and bond.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is we don't have that safety net of that root mass. Now, getting back to silt, you know, mm-hmm. if you look at the three what we call soil separates, the sand, silt, and clay. Sand, of course, is in water, is very heavy and will sink to the bottom of it.
Yep.
Clay will get suspended and it takes several hours for clay to settle out of water. But then if you look at the silt content, silt can tend to suspend itself in water. And quite often you'll get a customer, you know, I'll get a customer that'll call and say, I've got an infield soil that, you know, it's really greasy when it's wet. You know, which tells me there's not a lot of friction, okay? Pretty typical of a high silt content soil. The silt suspends itself, so you don't get a lot of frictional surface there, and it's just like walking on grease.
That's how we're taught to actually identify it in our soils classes, is that when you're ribboning it out, as they call it, and you run the soil between your fingertips, if it's smooth and silky, you've got a lot of silt in there.
You've got a lot of silt in it. Or when it's dry, it feels very feathery. You know, if you take a handful of infield soil and it's dry and it's pulverized, and you feel it and it feels really feathery, that's a sure sign that you've got a high silt content. But you know, most of the time, I can tell from a customer's comments before I even test the materials what their problem is. We just use the test to confirm what we're saying.
Well, you're just the expert.
Well, but
I can't. But most of us can't.
But you should be able to. I mean, because it's pretty easy,
to
like
a point.
To say. You know, like I said, if they give you that line that it feels really greasy or it's really slippery when it's wet, typically that's an indication that you've got a high silt content. If they talk about their foot sinking into the infield soil when it's wet, when it's really wet and they go down a half inch or so, that's a sign that there's not a lot of structural stability in that soil. A good chance that they're got too much fine sand in that infield soil, and they need to beef up the medium and coarse sand in that soil. Now, the worst possible case scenario that you can have for an infield soil is going to be one. Well, yeah, but that's not even a soil.
So I didn't even know that existed until I moved to the Midwest. That stuff's awful.
Let's just stay away from it for a minute. But sticking with a soil infield, if you go to a situation where you've got too much fine sand, fine and very fine sand in your infield soil, and too much silt, that is the worst of all evils. Those are the fields that take 2 to 3 days to firm up and dry up before you can ever use them again.
Oh, yeah.
They're really bad situations, and you've got to get in there and rectify it. Now, again, the beauty is nowadays we can fix fields that are in place without taking all the old dirt out. You know, in the old days, people used to say, well, I got to take all this out and put a whole new soil in. You don't have to do that anymore because the advent of engineered infield soils that has been around now for about 10 years and is becoming more and more the norm for infield soils. You'll always have your mom and pop soil suppliers that'll sell the harvested soils. But you're seeing more and more the bigger suppliers starting to investigate this whole thing with engineered soils.
You can justify the costs these days, you know, well, because you can get the play that you need, and you know that you can get the play that you need in order to balance out that cost benefit.
And I'll tell you something else is that if these engineered soils had been around 20 years ago, you wouldn't see so many of these infields that are being turned to artificial turf because these engineered infield soils perform so well after rainfalls and being able to get on them so quickly and having good structural stability that you can walk on them when it's raining, we wouldn't have the issues that we have.
Yeah.
And people saying, you know what, I'm fed up with dealing with infield soils. I'm just going to artificial turf my infield. I'm almost positive we wouldn't see as many of these artificial turf infields that have gone in over the past several years.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, the bottom line is that we can now fix these infield soils without taking out what you have in there by blending in different types of engineered soils to amend that soil, change the makeup of that soil permanently, and save you a lot of money from just going crazy. So,
but it all
starts with a test, and you got to do the test first, and you got to make sure they're using the proper testing procedures. We typically use the ASTM D422 test. The good news is that we're moving in the right direction. People are getting better materials. So look for those engineered infield soils. Get your soils tested. If you don't know where to go, you can go to your local extension offices and see if they test. Or you can go to some of the you can look up on the internet for soil testing companies, and if you're not sure out of those, you can certainly call me at Beacon and we can take care of those there. The only thing we test is for infield soils. We don't test soil fertility, which most of those other groups that I just talked about, they probably do more soil testing for fertility, but they also do physical properties. It's just that they're not used to looking at it from an infield soil standpoint and the use of it that soil as an infield soil.
Yep.
And that's the key. So now the question's going to come, okay, well, how do you take a sample? You know, I've got an infield soil. How do I sample it? Well, if you're using a top dressing on the infield, first of all, any place where you're going to take a sample, you want to brush that top dressing away. We don't want that to, I mean, you're going to get some in it anyways because some of it gets chewed in through the spikes impinging into the infield soil and things like that. But you'll pick about a dozen locations around your infield skin, all over the infield, baselines, home plate area, away from the clay areas for batter's box and whatnot.
That's a key point. Stay away from those clay areas.
Stay away from the clay areas. But in general, you pick about a dozen spots. And what I do is I go out there with a 5-gallon bucket, and I'll take a little garden shovel and basically, I take about a 3-inch by 3-inch by 3-inch deep sample out of each location. And once I've got that done, I put it, they're all in the bucket. I'll mix that bucket up really good, break all the soil clods up. So what I'm creating is a good representative soil sample of that infield. And then I fill up a quart-sized Ziploc bag. I'll write on there a name for that field, and then I send it off to wherever I'm having it tested. And, you know, for a physical soil test like that, it's typically called a particle size analysis. You're going to pay anywhere from – you might find them for as cheap as $100, but typically you're going to be more in the $125 to $200.
This isn't something you do every year. This is something
And it's not like fertility where you have to check it every year. You only have to check it when you change something in that soil, when you put something different in that soil, because it's not going to really change that much over time. So
exactly.
So we recommend that you take an initial soil test so you know what you got, and to see if you've got some issues there. And then if you're going to do some amending and to change that soil, then I always recommend that you wait, first of all, for about 6 months, and then go back in and do the sampling again and get a follow-up test so you can see how the adjustments affected the soil. And then once you get it where you've got it, you know, okay, this is where I want to keep it. So you just got to be very cognizant of what you're adding to the soils each mm-hmm. time you add. If you add a new soil in there, you better know what the makeup of that is before you put it in there so you can kind of understand how that may imping on your existing infield soils and the test that you have on it.
Good point.
So.
Excellent.
So that's my little science segment.
There's so much science and math in here today. It's beautiful.
On testing for infield soils. But it's a key thing that, in my opinion, every groundskeeper should know what their infields are made out of. And if you're not doing soil testing, you're totally guessing. And if you're guessing, chances are you're going to be wrong at what you do to those infield soils.
Well, and if you can't fix it this year, you know, hold on to your test. And then when you do get the opportunity, you'll already know what you need.
And the other thing about that, that you bring that up, Teresa, is that you don't have to fix it all at once.
That's
you can,
a good point.
From a cost standpoint, you can fix this a little bit at a time by adding some of that soil, a little bit at a time to get that change. The thing is that every time you add soil in there, you've got to blend it really well. You can't just throw it on top and say, okay, it's magic. No, there's more to it. You've got to go in and you've got to really aggressively blend that into the existing soil to make it one nice homogeneous blend.
And we'll talk about that kind of procedure here in a few minutes.
Let's go to break and we'll be right back with our Out of the Park segment. Happy New Year from Beacon Athletics. And with the new year comes our new 2016 catalog, chocked full of product for you sports field groundskeepers to maintain your athletic fields. If you don't have or never have received a Beacon catalog, simply give us a call at Beacon Athletics at 800-747-5985, and we'll rush one right out to you. You can also request a catalog from www.beaconathletics.com. Our web store has all of our products from the catalog and more. Plus, it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, ready and willing to take your orders. Start preparing for the 2016 season by shopping with us today.
Hi, I'm Andy Almond from the McLean County Pony Baseball Complex in Bloomington, Illinois. You're listening to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast.
Our Out of the Park interview today covers a subject that many of you have heard about in the past year or so in the news. It concerns what appears to be increasing incidences of fans being injured by flying objects, mainly baseball bats. With us today is Jim Merland, Beacon's on-staff engineer who designs backstops of all shapes and sizes for our Beacon customers all over the world. Jim, welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Now, Jim, when you and I were kids growing up and going to Major League Baseball games way back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
60s?
Yeah. Jim would have been going in the 60s. I wasn't. They used to have these big sprawling backstops that not only protected fans from the front of them, but also over the tops of their heads on the backstop.
They did?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Huh.
And a lot has changed both in backstop design over the years as well as ballpark design. So that's helped to contribute to some of these safety issues, I think, that have apparently increased recently.
I think that's true. I think it's also the case that the whole structure of the facilities have changed, and the proximity of the fans to the field itself and to home plate in particular has changed.
Yeah, and well, their inability to, and I don't blame anybody for this. I know I'm guilty of it. We got our cell phones, so when things get a little low or slow, we pull out our phones and we're not watching the game.
Exactly. You know,
that's true.
And I remember, of course, when I was with the Orioles and we were in the process of designing Oriole Park, our desire was to have the foul territories as small as possible. And I remember in the design stage, we went to Major League Baseball and asked if we could have our foul territories smaller than Wrigley Field, which at that time was the closest seating to the foul lines. And we asked for a special exception, and they wouldn't give it to us at that time. Now, since Camden Yards has been built, I know there have been a couple of ballparks that have been able to encroach that distance. And at the same time, I know Oriole Park has moved their seating in closer since we opened up the place. So there's been that change in the design standard, and really that change with Oriole Park. That's when all the other parks started moving it closer. You know, you go back to the older stadiums that are still around, like Dodger Stadium, you've got massive foul territory, so there's a lot more time for people to react to these things. But after Camden, you know, most of the new stadiums that were built much closer to the playing field. You know, and some of this, you know, was also in response to fans wanting to be unobstructed more. You know, the old backstops were a lot harder to see through than the current ones.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so fans used to complain a lot. You know, the box seat fans up near home plate used to complain a lot about the view. So in the newer ballparks, they shrunk those backstops down. So, you know, and again, like you say, Teresa, there's other things that have kind of distracted fans from paying attention to what's going on at the game.
Well, and actually, you're talking about the not being able to see very well, but you know that talking to a couple of our friends in the majors, that's something that the clubs are anticipating as far as rolling out these new netting requirements, is that the fans and or the sports writers are going to be upset that their views might be more obstructed.
All right. So basically, Major League Baseball came out with a recommendation from the Office of the Commissioner, which reads, you know, clubs are encouraged to implement or maintain netting or another effective protective screen or barrier of their choosing that shields from line drive foul balls all foul balls at all field level seats that are located between the near ends of both dugouts within 70 feet of home plate. So in other words, basically anything between dugouts, you know, is what they want to have covered. Does this statement fit your general recommendation, Jim, that you offer Beacon customers when you're talking to them about backstop nets?
Well, it you have to take it in context. This, of course, applies to major league facilities, big stadiums, where the people, the fans themselves, are really the only thing that requires some form of protection. So they have to do some kind of a study and anticipate where balls are likely to go and how many, to what extent netting can be used to protect those fans. When we're dealing with our customers, which do include the major leagues, but the majority of our customers would be schools and park and rec organizations, there's a lot more to think about in that application. Very often we're concerned about parking lots that are immediately behind the ball field or another ball field that's nearby, and so we need to protect people that might be watching a game on that facility. There's also buildings that might be close by. So there are a bunch of issues that come into play on the smaller sorts of facilities that maybe don't become an issue for either the minor leagues or the major leagues.
Yeah, and you know, the injuries that have occurred or that are most prominent that are being talked about aren't from foul balls as it is. It's from baseball bats that are flying into the stands.
It's the new wood bats, isn't it? They're not they ran out of the old wood?
They still produce ash, but I'm not sure it's the wood itself. I think a lot of it is the guys, you know, not holding onto the bats firm enough, to be honest with you. It's been bats that have been injuring people.
Yeah.
Well, and really, as you pointed out, they've moved the fans closer, so there's less and less time for anyone to react. And so whether it's a bat, which is obviously very dangerous, or a ball with the velocity that these people can hit that ball, and I would argue that in some ballparks, even if you are paying attention, you're unlikely to be able to move quickly enough to avoid an injury. And if you are lucky enough to move quickly enough, the person who's obstructed behind you is unlikely to have that reaction, and they're exposed and dangerous as well.
Excellent point.
Yeah, I mean, those seats are so close nowadays to the, you know, the ones near the ones between the end of the backstop and the start of the dugout, because there are very few parks that I can think of where the backstop netting was going dugout to dugout right now, at least before this recommendation came out. And if you had a chance to sit down by some of those seats and just, even not in a game situation, but just go down there and sit and see how close you are, I mean, it is not a lot of time to react. Now, they talk about the area's width of this backstop net that they want, but you notice, Jim, that they didn't say anything about the recommending height of a backstop. In major league parks, that's typically set to the highest point where, you know, without interfering the view of the guys in the press box, because they don't want their view obstructed. And I know that when we built Oriole Park, we were very cognizant of making that backstop net so it didn't intrude with the press box's view of the game. But let's say you are a college or high school and you have baseball and softball fields that you need to build some backstops on. How do you judge what the height should be for these facilities? I mean, you can't stop everything.
That's right.
Well, that's true. That's true. One question we would always ask is, how far is it between home plate and the center section of the backstop? Because you're working with a trajectory issue here. If you can force the ball to go much more vertically in order to get over the backstop, that won't necessarily stop it, but it will come down then on a more vertical flight. And that's considered to be a little less dangerous than a line drive or a very low trajectory ball. So that's part of it. As I mentioned earlier, it's also a question of what you're trying to protect. Are you just protecting a small group of fans immediately behind that backstop, or are you protecting a parking lot, a swimming pool, or some other activity that's further away?
Sure.
Those things come into play. The counterbalance to all of that is cost, because it is the height of the backstop largely that drives the cost. And the reason for that is the majority of the money is in the structural supports necessary to hold that net in place. And the loading that we have to anticipate is up to more than 90 miles an hour of wind loading for a properly designed facility. So that forces the size of the support structure to get larger and larger, and that's where about 70% of the cost is for these. So that's the trade-off. Effectiveness, the overall contribution to safety, balanced by the cost and complication of the installation.
Well, and to the commoner out there who doesn't deal with this every day like you do, they don't really realize, you know, they look at a net and they think, well, it's, you know, it's 90%, 95% open. They think, how much drag could there really be by the wind on those things? But if you get on the end of one of those things when you're putting one up and try and hang onto it, the wind can really grab those things.
It's quite amazing. We very commonly see cable loading in the 3,000 to 4,000 pound range when we run models that predict what those loads will be under full wind load condition. And that requires a pretty substantial structure to hold it, and that's what's driving the cost on these units.
Well, and in your situation, if you, like you say, if you're dealing with schools or parks, you literally are out in the open in a ballpark. You're kind of shielded to a certain degree by some of the structure of the ballpark from the winds from one direction at least.
Or it could be worse if you've got a funneling effect, depending on how the field was built. But
True.
Yeah, you're right for the most part. Yeah.
So there are several different types of backstops. Jim, can you kind of describe briefly the different styles and the pros and cons of each of those?
We can. We can start with the one that people are most familiar with in professional facilities, major league, minor league. And that's what we would refer to as a tie back. And people will picture a very, very long cable running sometimes from the second deck or the upper deck grandstand all the way down around the front and above the backstop area and then out to a similar location on the grandstand structure. That cable runs is anchored then at the higher level, and then it's grabbed onto and pulled back up towards typically the press box by a series of cables that put tension on and lift that top cable. And then the net is hung from that top cable going down. Now, we refer to that as a tie back. That can be done just as it is in the major league facilities with all existing grandstand structure, no poles. But very often in our world, as you pointed out, there is no structure. There isn't necessarily a press box or any sort of grandstand. And so we substitute that structure with poles. And we would locate poles either at either end of the dugout, and those would take the place of the upper deck. They would control that top cable, and then tieback cables would pull back and up to poles that might be set on either side of the bleacher unit that is behind. Again, that would be a tieback concept. The other is very much like a chain link fence without the chain link, netting substituting for the chain link, a series of poles that run in line with the backstop structure, and the net is hung directly from cables supported by those poles. Now, that does put the poles in the sight line. So all of those poles would be between what typically would be the bleachers of the grandstand area and the field itself. The purpose behind the tieback concept is to eliminate those sight line interferences and to make sure that there's nothing other than the net itself between the fans watching the game and the field itself.
And so from an affordability standpoint, where do each of these lie? If everything was equal, you know, if you're covering the same distance on both of these, is there one that's typically going to be more affordable than another? Or I imagine there's probably trade-offs when you're looking at cost. You can't solely look at cost.
Well, there are trade-offs, but again, I would argue that it's largely driven by height, which controls then either how many poles are required or the size of those poles. The fewer the poles, the larger they tend to be. An inline system also can have a complicating factor in that those poles may be related in some fashion to the wall or a wall that might be constructed at the base. It's very common to have a 2, 3, or 4 foot knee wall at the base, and it is more complicated to install poles into a wall like that than to have them completely separate in their own footings. Tieback generally can accomplish that. The tieback poles can be away from the field, away from other structure, and set in their own footings. Sometimes that's easier and less expensive for an installation. Tieback poles tend to be bigger because the loads are higher, because the poles have to be or are very often located further away from the backstop. They have to be taller usually than the net itself in order to provide some lift. So there's expense related to that as well.
You don't think about that. That's a lot of math. That's a lot of engineering that goes into those.
Well, that's why we have him working here.
I know. It's amazing. he can never retire.
And very often, more and more, in fact, projects that we're involved with, the controlling entity at that location for permitting purposes requires engineering calculations be done and signed by an engineer that is registered in that state. So we work with an engineering firm that can run proprietary models, load models that we've created, and they have the ability to stamp the results in all 50 states, and that's critical.
Wow.
We typically have them working on 3 or 4 projects at any one time. I would say that even 8-9 years ago, that was very uncommon. It was required on maybe 5% of the projects we were involved with. And now I would say it's probably 60% of the projects.
Because if you didn't have that, then you'd have to pay a whole new consult fee to bring in another engineer or company, engineering company, to go over all of everything that you'd already put together, essentially. Is that right?
That's correct. And would have to be a company or an individual that's registered in that
that
location,
yeah. Right.
Which then you've got communication issues. It's fairly complicated fairly quickly.
Yeah.
It's all, realistically, these are big structures around which people are going to be watching a game. You wouldn't think they'd be watching one in a tornado, but nonetheless, the ordinances and local code requirements still apply. It's like a piece of a building, and it has to be treated much the same way.
Yeah. Well, even if the people aren't there, the bits can go flying off in a tornado. So
that's right. That's right.
Now, you talked about the visibility with the tieback backstops, where you don't have any poles in the way or anything like that. You know, you'll have some thin cables that makes it pretty easy to see around. But you know, the other thing that's changed a little bit has been the materials that the backstops are made of themselves, the actual netting material. And when I first started with the Orioles back in '85 at Old Memorial Stadium, you know, we were dealing with a tieback backstop there, but the material that they used back then for the mesh was a welded wire mesh and fairly thick gauged and very hard to look through. Then when we moved to Oriole Park, we went to what was state of the art at the time. You know, we're talking 1992, and it was this especially strong, looked like chicken wire, which was much thinner gauge and really easy to see through. Now, we never had a ball go through it, so it was effective, but it would dimple wherever a ball hit. But nowadays, you're using more invisible types of what I would call a soft netting mesh versus the wire products that we used to use. Plus, there's all these confusion by groundskeepers of how netting is described, such as the 504 or a 42A. Can you kind of describe the materials that are used now and make any sense of what these net fabric nomenclature calls these nets?
Sure. First off is the construction of the net itself. In general terms, there are either knotless, which is a woven together net, or knotted netting. And I would guess that most people are familiar with the knotted netting. Many batting cages are typically knotted. So a twisted knotted construction or a woven knotless construction. And then the materials can vary. The most common material that we use and that we're aware of in the kind of application, backstop applications, is a twisted nylon. We like the nylon because of its abrasion resistance. We like how it responds to weather. And it seems to function very well for a lengthy period of time. And it's a reasonable cost. The next step in terms of material would be the Dyneemas or Spectra materials, much, much stronger. So consequently, the leg, if you will, of the netting itself can be made thinner. There are fewer fibers. They're quite a bit stronger. It is an easier material to look through, but the cost is 3 to 4 times that of nylon. It's actually coming down, but it's quite a bit more expensive. I would say the vast majority of minor league and major league fields that I've visited have a Dyneema type net. Of course, cost is less of an issue for them. But at the high school level, for sure, park and rec level, it's almost entirely nylon. And colleges, it's a mix. The nylon is a little thicker, a little bit more obstruction to the view. But the cost difference justifies that in many instances.
Now, you know, you've been doing this for, 17 years? Something like that, 17, 18 years?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen some commonality of some mistakes that are made in people who put backstops up and then suddenly they fail and then they call you and say, we put this backstop up and something went wrong. Can you relate to us? The one thing I remember is that one picture that you guys had of somebody who decided to put flagpoles up for the poles to hold the netting. Yeah, you know, I think you know the pictures I'm talking about. They had an ice storm or something like that, and all those poles just bent right down near the base. Yeah, it was. It's an impressive picture.
That's probably that is something that we do see on occasion, and it's the most catastrophic mistake to make, and that is just underestimating the loads that these nets can apply to the structure. Choosing the wrong material, choosing too small of vertical pipe, if that's what's being used, too small of cables, things of that nature. That is certainly a mistake that we see. Another one that we see is underestimating the degree to which the net will move. It has to move. It's not like chain link where a ball hits it and it just it ricochets off. The net is going to move to absorb the energy when it's hit by a ball. And if that's not accounted for, it could move that net far enough to actually come in contact with a fan if he's standing too close behind the net. But it can also push the net into some other structure. For example, a press box that's separate from the net itself, but immediately behind the backstop wall. And once that starts to happen, once the ball can squeeze the net between itself and a hard object, the net starts to fail very, very quickly. So those are two issues. Another one that we run into is architects that want to bring the net all the way down to field grade or very close, as opposed to, say, to a three-foot-high wall. The two issues there is I would argue that is an unsafe circumstance for the catcher or a player that might run into the net, because the net's not going to stop them until they've fallen into it to some degree.
Sure.
So having that wall there helps them position themselves on the field. But the other biggest factor is rabbits and mice like to chew on the netting. And if they can get to it, they will. And now you've got a series of holes in the netting, 6, 8, 10 inches up from the ground, and it's unfortunate. It's very premature damage that could have otherwise been eliminated by simply putting it on a wall or some structure. Even a fence, a chain link fence, a 3-foot chain link fence would get the bottom of the net up high enough so that it's not going to be exposed to that.
Well, I think the other thing you could add to that, the other danger of doing just that is that if you bring that net all the way down to the ground and you've got little kids at the facility watching that game, they don't know any better. They're going to walk up right to that net and one foul ball or something, a bat being thrown, come to that. Like you say, there's going to be some flex in that net that's going to come back towards them, and they aren't going to understand that. You know, they're young kids.
And parents and fans have been taught to presume that the structure has been pre-approved for safety.
Right.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
So they're going to get hit. So
if it weren't safe, yeah.
You know, that 3-foot knee wall does a lot of good in helping protect a lot of young kids with that kind of a setup. So, yeah, I agree. You know, another problem that we see a lot of is, and I can speak to this from experience when my son was playing Little League, you know, you get into these complexes where you've got multiple fields, like a 4-field cloverleaf. And it's a common design that you see around the country. And they put up 4 fields, and there's common grounds between each of the fields. And you've got, two sets of bleachers. The fans are looking one direction at one field on one side, and at the other side of that common area, there's going to be fans looking the other direction. And a foul ball from one field comes and hits the fans who are watching in the opposite direction, the game going on that they're looking at. How do you protect those kind of people? And can a backstop do that, or are there other things that you can do to help stop that?
First off, if that problem is anticipated at the time that the facility is designed, then you can do some things in the original fabrication of the overall facility. Locating poles and running cables, and it can be done fairly effectively, although it's quite expensive on any size installation. Almost always it's after the fact. These things aren't taken into account during the design phase. It's after the facility opens and somebody gets hit. And then the question is, how can you do this effectively? One option we can extend a canopy, a net canopy, out from a chain link backstop. Sometimes you see a little extension of chain link. That's very ineffective, expensive, and adds weight to the overall structure. But we can go out with a series of poles and cables and actually enclose that to a greater extent. Now, any kind of canopy of that nature will affect play. There'll be pop-ups that a catcher is unable to catch as a result.
Sure.
At the 10, 12-year-old level, that may be a reasonable price to pay. But certainly by the time you get to high school, that starts to become an overriding issue. The other option in this sort of circumstance is to go more locally to where the fans are. Now, I understand there's a lot of walkways and other things that they'd be less protected. Perhaps some kind of landscaping would help. But at the bleacher units themselves, there could be a shade structure put over the bleacher. There could be a localized net that's installed that just provides protection for people who are actually watching one game. As people move around the facility, as they are running, walking along walkways or going to the concession stand, it becomes a little more difficult to do without a massive netting project. So a combination of canopies where they can be done effectively, localized protection, shade structures or nets over bleacher units, and some kind of landscaping along pathways is probably the most cost-effective way to retrofit and solve a problem after the facility's been built.
Yeah. I know that I recommend quite a few times to people, again, based on my experiences from when my son was playing at these complexes, that, you know, it's hard to stop every ball. But one of the things they can do at these cloverleaf-type things is look at some deciduous trees in there that will grow and mature and have nice big canopies that will provide a couple different things. First of all, of course, it's going to provide some protection. The ball gets in that tree, knocks around a couple times, certainly comes down on a much slower speed. But the other thing it provides is fan comfort from shade, because if you've ever sat at these clover leaves that are out in the middle of nowhere with a burning sun and a strong south wind, it is daunting to sit through a 6-7-8 inning game in July and August heat without any kind of shades to keep the fans comfortable. So that's one thing I'd always look at.
That also recommends the shade structure itself. One thing, you don't have to wait for 20 years for it to grow. Another is it adds color and in many instances can be part of the representation of the facility as to how that's done. It does add some expense, but probably less than a completely inclusive net canopy system.
Right. Now, I imagine in those particular settings as well, there are a lot of situations where you've been contacted about protecting playgrounds.
That's right. It's not uncommon for a field to have an adjacent playground that's part of the overall attraction, the entertainment package. Bring your kids, let them play on what in many instances is a very elaborate, very well thought out playground, only to realize that it's 40 or 50 feet off the foul line and is certainly exposed to foul balls. So there again, we have done a full shade structure over them where that could be done. That's a nice thing to do. We've also done just a net structure, two or four poles, some kind of a peaked net system located over the facility. Sometimes a vertical net will work because it's close enough to the field that it's unlikely that a ball will go over the top and come down onto the playground, but they are exposed to more of a line drive issue, somewhat like those fans sitting near the dugouts would be.
Well, Jim, I appreciate your expertise today on backstop design and things. And I guess I want to close in asking your opinion, and purely your opinion and nothing more than that. Do you think Major League Baseball, with these new stadiums as close as they are, have gone far enough for protection and in their recommendations, or do you think there's another step farther they should go?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see how they interpret those. One thing they mention is all field level seating. Now, I'm not sure whether that's the first row or is that the whole first section of box seats up to the first landing behind. That will obviously determine how tall the netting will have to be. So it's not just the extension along the foul lines, but also the height that they go to. But certainly they have to anticipate response time issues for those fans that are sitting so close to those small backstops. And it will be very interesting also to see how they do it, because it's going to be a challenge to float some new netting out into those locations without adding the kind of structure that would really be an impediment to sight lines, and I'm sure cause some consternation with their fan group. So it's going to be an interesting challenge. We are working with two minor league teams right now that are very serious about it. They're actually putting full-height nets all the way to the far end of their dugouts, in one instance 100 feet. So they're actually extending their backstop 100 feet all the way across the top of those dugouts. And they're going to support that net by poles that are set outside of the stadium beyond the outfield fence.
Wow.
So
it's
a pretty extensive undertaking, not inexpensive, but they've obviously interpreted the recommendations very seriously, and they're committed to doing what they think is absolutely necessary to protect their fans.
Well, but fans have to accept some amount of risk in this situation. I mean, there's no way to protect everybody unless you're using the cone of silence of, you know, a clear plastic bubble you're going
to
sit over you.
They have to, but they're not going to want to.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, they put up signs to warn people, which is required by their insurance companies to do that, by the way. You know, you put up so much netting. But, you know, extending that netting of that one ballpark that you're talking about, Jim, that's great for the fan that's looking straight through that. But as a fan that's sitting farther down the line that's got to look through that net at an angle, the steeper that angle, as you well know, Jim, the more you're cutting down that vision.
That's absolutely right. And but at the same time, all of the fans are accepting some level of responsibility for anything that goes up and over the backstop nets, because I'm not aware of anyone interpreting this regulation to include the addition of some kind of horizontal or angled netting overhead.
That'll be the next recommendation in a couple of years, probably. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for being on the show. We really appreciate your expertise on this subject.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
At Beacon Athletics, we've been helping America maintain and improve its ball field since 1948. We're innovators. We're out on our test fields every day developing products that simply do the job better, like the Streamliner Chalker and the Sweet Spot Tamp System. Everything we do for the love of the game. We're so confident in our commitment to the industry that we at Beacon have a promise. We'll provide great products and great service so there is no risk for you. When you place an order with us, we know you need your stuff, so we promise to ship all in-stock items in 24 hours. If you're not happy, neither are we. We guarantee your satisfaction, period. We'll refund your purchase price and pay for the return shipping. If you have questions, we have answers. We actually use all of our products, so we know all the ins and outs. We are Beacon Athletics, and that's our promise to you.
Hi, this is Mike Buchholder, Director of Field Operations for the Philadelphia Phillies, and you're listening to Diamond Da Vinci's podcast.
Well, that segment made me very happy, Paul. There was so much math and engineering.
You and your engineer, you're getting all excited over there.
I love it.
Apparently, my soil talk didn't trip your trigger.
No. This is turning out to be one of my favorite episodes because it's sneakily full of science.
When do we get into the grass cutting season?
There's science there, too. So let's talk a little bit about the art.
Okay.
Talk to us about, now we've gotten our soil test, we know what we can do to remediate all of that for our infield, but what should we be doing every year? What should we be thinking about coming up into the spring? Either, I mean, I know down in Texas and Alabama, they're already playing, so they got to find a way to fit this in, you know, transition zone. They're getting ready to start thinking about this procedure and getting their infields ready for the spring. What do we do? Where do we start? I mean, do I just grab a tiller and go nuts?
well, let me
sometimes
start.
Sometimes that's what it feels like I do in the spring.
Let me start that out, that by the north versus the south is going to be different. There's different situations.
I've got lots of southerners who will always agree with you on that.
With grass, sure. I mean, you're going to deal with your infields differently or you're going to treat your fields differently with grass in north versus south. You get the same thing with the infield skin, because down south, your fields don't freeze. And
in the transition zone, they might. Depends on the year. But for the most part, they don't freeze deeply. Not the way they do up here. Yeah.
Right. So there is kind of two different methods to bringing your fields up ready for play for the season. Down south, the beauty is that you've got all winter to do whatever it is that you need to do to
unless
get it ready
all winter,
for the coming spring. Well, I was going to add that as a caveat. But yes, unless you've got, you know, events every week or every couple of weeks there that you've got to deal with, you're right. You've got that. Now, in a lot of cases, there are guys out there who, for instance, a high school or a college, that they're busy working on football during this time, so they can't do it then, and they're still stuck with late winter, early spring to get their fields ready. But still, down south, it's going to be a lot easier. So they've got a lot of time to take care of it. And they're already probably playing down there. They're already practicing. Mm-hmm. So they've probably got that work done. And I suspect that they're probably, you know, got to have their place ready to go shortly after the Christmas break.
I would think,
You know, so what they're typically doing is what we'll do a lot here in the north in the fall or after the season's over is, you know, they've gone in, they've probably gone in, and if they've had grade issues on their infield soils, they've gone in and regraded it, re-leveled it somehow, hopefully. They've taken care of any problems with their lips. If they've got lips that form, they've gone in there. Not those lips, the other ones.
You guys couldn't see it. I made duck face at him.
So, you know, they're hopefully taking care of any lip issues so that they keep their surface drainage in good shape, and they've re-leveled those infields. And if their soil test has indicated to them that they have some issues, or somebody has told them through looking at their soil test that they have some issues, they've got a lot of time to do that, and they can go in there and till it. Now, one question that a lot of people ask me is, do I need to till my infield? I would say if your infield is performing fine, there's really no reason to.
I would agree.
You're just maintaining that top surface as it is to begin with.
The freezing over the winter is not going to affect that performance by and large if it's performing well, correct?
Right. And right now I'm really just talking about the south. I'm not even touching on the frozen tundra. But the only time unless players are really complaining about the field being too hard, which part of that's probably going to be moisture, you really don't need to go in there and rototill that. Now, you know, if you haven't done it in 3-4 years and you want to turn it over, that's understandable, because you will get situations where you're getting a buildup of top dressing material or something like that might be getting pretty heavy in concentration in the upper layer of your infield soil. So it doesn't hurt to turn it every couple of years. Every year, I'm not so sure you need to do that. Unless you've got a situation where your field is really hard, then I would say you don't have to do that. If you do have a situation where your field is really hard, you do have more than just rototilling that you can do it to. Because rototilling, you know, when you think about it, it really goes in and pulverizes that soil. So what happens when we do that? We're adding a lot of pore space. And it takes a long time for that soil to firm back up to the point of where it was before. As I always say, you've destroyed the integrity of that infield for at least a couple of weeks until sun and rain and wind can work to really congeal that that soil back to where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, just hitting it with a one-ton roller isn't going to reestablish that.
No, you'll never get rid of all that pore space that you put in by rototilling. So you got to keep that in mind.
And there's
a balance. What we used to do, you know, if, let's say, and this happened on a rare occasion, Cal would come to me and say, my portion of the infield is getting too tight. Can you do something about it? I said, sure. And we've done this actually on game days where we've gone out with our aerifier and actually aerified that infield soil. You got to have the right moisture content. But we'll aerify that infield soil and then drag the plugs back into the holes and everything. Mm-hmm. Now, what we've done is we've opened it up, which allow it to soften because it'll take more water in. But we have not destroyed the integrity of that surface. The ball will still bounce properly across there and act the way it did the day before when Cal was playing in that position.
Yeah.
So that's typically what I'll do in season if something happens and we're in the middle of a homestand or whatever. Mm-hmm. But to rototill, again, you're just adding so much pore space that the only time I really hold that out as an option to work on infields is when I'm adding material. I'm blending in a new material and I want to get a good homogeneous blend. Mm-hmm. Now, let's switch to the north. Mm-hmm. Okay. North, we got a little bit bigger problems here.
It's a deeper freeze.
It's a deeper freeze. You've got the season ends in typically, you know, depending on what level you're playing at, Little
September,
League, you
October.
Could end in July or you could be playing fall ball all the way through October like we do at our Little League complex. So we typically have about a month before everything freezes up. So we have to concern ourselves with sodding, overseeding, not just the infield skins.
Yep.
So what we typically do is we'll take care of at least getting our edging done, any sodding that's got to be done along the edges of the infield. We'll get all that done, lips taken out, any of that kind of stuff we'll try and get done before everything freezes up. Aside from that, we'll leave it. We'll let it go for the winter. Hmm. And then there's this magic thing called the freeze-thaw cycle that occurs over wintertime up north here.
Yep.
And what it is it's Mother Nature's way of aerifying our soil here.
That's a good way to look at it, but yeah.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, that's why, you know.
Especially in an infield where you're going to have more clay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, in the spring, the first thing we'll do is we'll go to our home plate areas and our mound area, well, especially the home plate area, where you get buildup and it's too hard to scrape up sometimes in the fall to get it back down to grade. If we wait till spring, well, Mother Nature's done our work for us. She's lifted it up. Mm-hmm. She's opened up pore space, made it really easy for us to just scrape off the high spots that we've got on the home plate areas, and we can regrade that really quick and really easy. The infield soils, now here's what happens up here. I'll give you the typical scenario, and I get these calls all the time. High schools will call me and say, I got this coach who's dying to get on this field, and he looks at it at 8 o'clock in the morning, and he says, what's wrong with it? It's perfectly dry. Why can't we get out there? There's still frost in the ground. Mm-hmm. So he's looking at it first thing in the morning. It's frozen. It looks dry to him. It doesn't look frozen. It looks dry to him.
Yeah.
But you know as a groundskeeper that by noontime, after some sun's been on there, it's a soaking wet, slimy mess. But they fight this battle with these guys all the time.
Yeah.
And I tell them, I said, look, don't let them go out there till after the frost is out of the ground. How will you know when the frost is out of the ground? Well, first of all, you'll know by that all that extra water and softness that you have in your soil. As soon as that frost is totally out of the ground, shoom, that water is going to go right through that profile. You're going to get the movement through there, and it drains really quick, and suddenly you start getting the drying going on because the March winds come in, dry it out, and you get it on. But it's these coaches that want to push the envelope and play baseball up here in the north in the middle of February.
Well, they're competing against, you know, especially when you get into the upper high school level and depending on the high schools. But, yeah, college level and all of that, they're competing against guys from the south.
Yeah, yeah. And in high school, what they need to do in high school up here in the far north is they need to take their baseball seasons like they do in the state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. And the high school baseball season in the state of Iowa is in the summertime. It's not in the spring. They actually play high school baseball then. And I know parts of northern Wisconsin do the same thing. Mm-hmm. But that should be, in my opinion, that should be a universal thing for high schools up here in the extreme north.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is you really can't do much to your infields till after the frost is out of the ground. And again, the frost is going to do all that natural aerification. So you know, you wonder why your field's nice and soft in spring. That's why. You wonder why your field will get wet and stay wet longer, because it's absorbing so much more water because of all the pore space. Mm. So the first thing you do after that field has lost the frost, and you get that first little bit of dryness on your field, enough so you can get your equipment out there,
uh-huh,
is you get out there with a roller and recompact it, because you want to evacuate all that pore space that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to, after that, then if you want to go in there and do any adding of material, re-leveling of the infield, adjustments, you can do it then. Or, you know, typically if I'm going to add soil to my infield to adjust the makeup of it, mm-hmm, I'm going to do that in the fall. Because I want that time.
You've
I want
got
that
more
moisture.
Time.
Well, you got more time. You're not backed up against the start of the season. And you've got a drier soil to work with, which makes it a lot easier. In the spring, you've got so much ground moisture to work with.
Yeah.
That makes it much more difficult.
That makes a lot of sense. That's one of the biggest problems I've seen up here is running into the season. And it happens down south too. I don't want to negate that.
Yeah.
Especially in the transition zone down to North Carolina, South Carolina, that area. It happens down there too, but it's, you know, there's certain things that can't be done until the spring.
But this is why materials like the ag lime we were talking about earlier in the show, mm-hmm, or the brick dust, mm-hmm, and this is why people use this stuff up here in the north, because it's not soil. It's not going to get muddy. So they put it on there and they make that their 4-inch profile. Mm. And they go, it's great. We can go out there in February when it's 29 degrees and play ball. Yeah, what ball player loves to play at 29 degrees when they swing the bat and you get the vibration?
Right.
That hurts. Not to mention, it's just, you know, those surfaces are a nasty surface to play on.
Yeah, they really are.
From a ball player standpoint. So that's why those have become so popular. But, you know, for me, you try and get as much of that work done in the fall. You want to put your fields to bed. Mm-hmm. Ready to go for the spring if you can. Not everybody's got that option.
Yeah.
So, but you try and do whatever little task you can so that in the spring when the time comes along, you're ready to go. So, again, you wait for the fields to dry out. You get a good roll on it to make sure everything's compacted again. And then you can start doing your nail dragging and floating the field, getting it set, adding soil where you need to get your grade right. And really that's the most critical thing to do as you get your season underway, is to make sure you've got your grade right so the water's running off of it.
And we'll talk about some more info on grading in a later show as well.
Yes, we will, as a matter of fact.
Well, Paul, you have your book ready?
It is in the books for the show.
Don't miss a minute of our next show. There are many places to find our podcast on the web, and of course, there's our main page at beaconathletics.com/podcast. You can also download our show on Apple iTunes, and don't forget to leave a review if you do that. We'd love to know what you think. You can also go to our partners, baseballtalkradio.com or baseballpodcast.net, where you'll find our podcast along with a lot of other really great baseball-oriented podcasts for all of the baseball junkies out there. So check them out. They've got a lot of great shows. We've been enjoying them. And they're going to be that much more enjoyable now that the season's getting started and we can start talking about all the speculation and spring training. Excellent.
Absolutely. We'd love to hear from you. You can email Teresa and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your questions or comments on our show, good or bad. If you have show ideas, send them, especially send those now, because we're still in the process of setting up our year of shows. We've got some stuff scheduled already for the early part of the year, but we're still setting up our show schedule for the rest of the year. So get those cards and letters in.
And don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Diamond Da Vinci's. That's at Diamond DAVINCIS. Not crazy active there, but we always share some stuff every once in a while, and it's a good way to keep up.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, I will say that's all, folks.
Ibbidi, ibbidi, adios.